Chapter 26. Summer. He wears no clothes, but a thin and scanty white shirt. He wields a staff and stalks along scowling and barefoot. His immense shock of black hair streams behind him, and his brown brawny body is curled over with black hair, like a savage man. This saint has the largest harem in the town. He is said to be enormously rich by the contributions he has levied, and is so adored for his holiness by the infatuated folk, that when he returns from the hag, which he does on horseback, the chief mollus going out to meet him, and escort him home in state along the Izbiki road, the people fling themselves down under the horse's feet, eager to be trampled upon and killed, and confident of heaven, if the great Haji's horse will but kick them into it. Was it my fault, if I thought of Haji Daniel, and the believers in him? There was no dervish of repute on the plain when I passed, only one poor wild fellow, who was dancing, with glaring eyes and grizzled beard, rather to the contempt of the bystanders, as I thought, who by no means put coppers into his extended bowl. On this poor devil's head there was a poor devil still a live cock, entirely plucked, but ornamented with some bits of ragged tape and scarlet and tinsel, the most horribly grotesque and miserable object I ever saw. A little way from him, there was a sort of play going on, a clown and a knowing one, like Whittacombe and the clown with us, the buffoon answering with blundering responses, which made all the audience shout with laughter. But the only joke which was translated to me would make you do anything but laugh, and shall therefore never be revealed by these lips. All their humor, my dragoman tells me, is of this questionable sort, and a young Egyptian gentleman, son of a pasha, whom I subsequently met at Malta, confirmed the statement, and gave a detail of the practices of private life which was anything but edifying. The great aim of woman, he said, in the much maligned Orient, is to administer to the brutality of her lord. Her merit is in knowing how to vary the beast's pleasures. He could give us no idea, he said, of the wit of the Egyptian women, and their skill in double entendre. Nor, I presume, did we lose much by our ignorance. What I would urge, humbly, however, is this: do not let us be led away by German writers and aesthetics, semi-lassoisms, Hananisms, and the like. The life of the East is a life of brutes. The much maligned Orient, I am confident, has not been maligned near enough, for the good reason that none of us can tell the amount of horrible sensuality practiced there. Beyond the jack-pudding rascal and his audience, there was on the green a spot, on which was pointed out to me a mark, as of blood. That morning the blood had spouted from the neck of an Arnaut soldier, who had been executed for murder. These Arnauts are the curse and terror of the citizens. Their camps are without the city, but they are always brawling, or drunken, or murdering within, in spite of the rigid law which is applied to them, and which brings one or more of the scoundrels to death almost every week. Some of our party had seen this fellow borne by the hotel the day before, in the midst of a crowd of soldiers who had apprehended him. The man was still formidable to his score of captors. His clothes had been torn off. His limbs were bound with cords, but he was struggling frantically to get free, and my informant described the figure and appearance of the naked, bound, writhing savage as quite a model of beauty. Walking in the street, this fellow had just before been struck by the looks of a woman who was passing, and laid hands on her. She ran away, and he pursued her. She ran into the police barrack, which was luckily hard by, but the Arnaut was nothing daunted, and followed into the midst of the police. One of them tried to stop him. The Arnaut pulled out a pistol, and shot the policeman dead. He cut down three or four more, before he was secured. He knew his inevitable end must be death. That he could not seize upon the woman. That he could not hope to resist half a regiment of armed soldiers. Yet his instinct of lust and murder was too strong, and so he had his head taken off quite calmly this morning, many of his comrades attending their brother's last moments. He cared not the least about dying, and knelt down, and had his head off as coolly as if he were looking on at the same ceremony performed on another. When the head was off, and the blood was spouting on the ground, a married woman, who had no children, came forward very eagerly out of the crowd, to smear herself with it, the application of criminals' blood being considered a very favorable medicine for women afflicted with barrenness, so she indulged in this remedy. But one of the Arnauts standing near said, "What, you like blood, do you?" or words to that effect, "Et see how yours mixes with my comrades." And thereupon, taking out a pistol, he shot the woman in the midst of the crowd, and the guards who were attending the execution, was seized of course by the latter, and no doubt tomorrow morning will have his head off too. It would be a good chapter, to write the death of the Arnaut, but I shan't go. Seeing one man hanged is quite enough in the course of a life. Jai-i-it, as the Frenchman said of hunting. These Arnauts are the terror of the town. They seized hold of an Englishman the other day, and were very nearly pistoling him. Last week one of them murdered a shopkeeper at Balak, who refused to sell him a watermelon at a price which he, the soldier, fixed upon it. So, for the matter of 3 halfpence, he killed the shopkeeper, and had his own rascally head chopped off, universally regretted by his friends. Why, I wonder, does not His Highness the Pasha invite the Arnauts to a dejeuner at the citadel, as he did the Mamelukes, and serve them up the same sort of breakfast? The walls are considerably heightened since Emin Bey and his horse leapt them, and it is probable that not one of them would escape. This sort of pistol practice is common enough here, it would appear, and not among the Arnauts merely, but the higher orders. Thus, a short time since, one of His Highness's grandsons, whom I shall call Bluebeard Pasha lest a revelation of the name of the said Pasha might interrupt our good relations with his country, one of the young Pashas being rather backward in his education, and anxious to learn mathematics, and the elegant deportment of civilized life, sent to England for a tutor. I have heard he was a Cambridge man, and had learned both algebra and politeness under the Reverend Dr. Whizzle, of college. One day when Mr. McWhirter, B.A., was walking in Shawbra Gardens, with His Highness the young Bluebeard Pasha, inducting him into the usages of polished society, and favoring him with reminiscences of Trumpington, there came up a poor fella, who flung himself at the feet of young Bluebeard, and calling for justice in a loud and pathetic voice, and holding out a petition, besought His Highness to cast a gracious eye upon the same, and see that his slave had justice done him. Bluebeard Pasha was so deeply engaged, and interested by his respected tutor's conversation, that he told the poor fellow to go to the deuce, and resumed the discourse which his ill-timed outcry for justice had interrupted. But the unlucky wight of a fellow was pushed by his evil destiny, and thought he would make yet another application. So he took a short cut down one of the garden lanes, and as the prince and the Reverend Mr. McWhirter, his tutor, came along once more engaged in pleasant disquisition, behold the fellow was once more in their way, kneeling at the august Bluebeard's feet, yelling out for justice as before, and thrusting his petition into the royal face. When the prince's conversation was thus interrupted a second time, his royal patience and clemency were at an end. "An," said he, "once before I bade thee, not to pester me with thy clamor, and lo, you have disobeyed me, take the consequences of disobedience to a prince, and thy blood be upon thine own head." So saying, he drew out a pistol, and blew out the brains of that fella, so that he never bawled out for justice any more. The Reverend Mr. McWhirter was astonished at this sudden mode of proceeding. "Gracious prince," said he, "we do not shoot an undergraduate at Cambridge even for walking over a college grass plot. Let me suggest to your royal highness, that this method of ridding yourself of a poor devil's importunities is such as we should consider abrupt and almost cruel in Europe. Let me beg you to moderate your royal impetuosity for the future, and, as your highness's tutor, entreat you to be a little less prodigal of your powder and shot. Oh Mala," said His Highness, here interrupting his governor's affectionate appeal, "You are good to talk about Trumpington and the Ponza Syndrome, but if you interfere with the course of justice in any way, or prevent me from shooting any dog of an Arab who snarls at my heels, I have another pistol, and, by the beard of the Prophet, a bullet for you too." So saying, he pulled out the weapon, with such a terrific and significant glance at the Reverend Mr. McWhirter, that gentleman wished himself back in his combination room again, and is by this time, let us hope, safely housed there. Another facetious anecdote, the last of those I had from a well-informed gentleman residing at Cairo, whose name has many copies of this book, that is to be, will be in the circulating libraries there, I cannot, for obvious reasons, mention. The revenues of the country come into the August treasury through the means of farmers, to whom the districts are let out, and who are personally answerable for their quota of the taxation. This practice involves an intolerable deal of tyranny and extortion on the part of those engaged to levy the taxes, and creates a corresponding duplicity among the fellows, who are not only wretchedly poor among themselves, but whose object is to appear still more poor, and guard their money from their rapacious overseers. Thus the Orient is much maligned, but everybody cheats there. That is a melancholy fact. The Pasha robs and cheats the merchants, knows that the overseer robs him, and bides his time, until he makes him disgorge by the application of the tremendous bastinado. The overseer robs and squeezes the laborer, and the poverty-stricken devil cheats and robs in return, and so the government moves in a happy cycle of roguery. Deputations from the fellows and peasants come perpetually before the August presence, to complain of the cruelty and exactions of the chiefs set over them. But, as it is known, that the Arab never will pay without the bastinado, their complaints, for the most part, meet with but little attention. His Highness's treasury must be filled, and his officers supported in their authority. However, there was one village, of which the complaints were so pathetic, and the inhabitants so supremely wretched, that the royal indignation was moved at their story, and the chief of the village, Skinflint Beg, was called to give an account of himself at Cairo. When he came before the presence, Mehemet Ali reproached him with his horrible cruelty and exactions, asked him how he dared to treat his faithful and beloved subjects in this way, and threatened him with disgrace, and the utter confiscation of his property, for thus having reduced a district to ruin. "Your Highness says I have reduced these fellows to ruin," said Skinflint Beg. "That is the best way to confound my enemies, and to show you the falsehood of their accusations, that I have ruined them? To bring more money from them. If I bring you 500 purses from my village, will you acknowledge that my people are not ruined yet?" The heart of the Pasha was touched. "We'll have no more bastinadoing, O Skinflint Beg. You have tortured these poor people so much, and have got so little from them, that my royal heart relents for the present, and I will have them suffer no farther. Give me free leave, give me your Highness's gracious pardon, and I will bring the 500 purses as surely as my name is Skinflint Beg. I demand only the time to go home, the time to return, and a few days to stay, and I will come back as honestly as Regulus Pasha did to the Carthaginians. I will come back and make my face white before your Highness." Skinflint Beg's prayer for a reprieve was granted, and he returned to his village, where he forthwith called the elders together. "Friends," he said, "complaints of our poverty and misery have reached the royal throne, and the benevolent heart of the sovereign has been melted by the words that have been poured into his ears. My heart yearns towards my people of El Mahdi," apostrophe he says. "I have thought how to relieve their miseries. Near them lies the fruitful land of El Gweni. It is rich in maize and cotton, in sesame and barley. It is worth 1,000 purses, but I will let it to my children for 700, and I will give over the rest of the profit to them, as an alleviation for their affliction. apostrophe, the elders of Elmadi knew the great value and fertility of the lands of Guini, but they doubted the sincerity of their governor, who, however, dispelled their fears and adroitly quickened their eagerness to close with the proffered bargain. "Will myself advance 250 purses," he said. "Do you take counsel among yourselves, and subscribe the other 500. And when the sum is ready, a deputation of you shall carry it to Cairo, and I will come with my share, and we will lay the whole at the feet of His Highness." So the gray-bearded ones of the village advised with one another, and those who had been inaccessible to bastinados somehow found money at the calling of interest. And the sheikh, and they, and the 500 purses, set off on the road to the capital. When they arrived, Skinflint Beg and the elders of Elmadi sought admission to the royal throne, and there laid down their purses. "Here is your humble servant's contribution," said Skinflint, producing his share, "and here is the offering of your loyal village of Elmadi. Did I not before say that enemies and deceivers had maligned me before the august presence, pretending that not a piaster was left in my village, and that my extortion had entirely denuded the peasantry? See, here is proof that there is plenty of money still in Elmadi. In 12 hours the elders have subscribed 500 purses, and laid them at the feet of their lord." Instead of the bastinado, Skinflint Beg was instantly rewarded with the royal favor, and the former mark of attention was bestowed upon the fellows who had maligned him. Skinflint Beg was promoted to the rank of Skinflint Bey, and his manner of extracting money from his people may be studied with admiration in a part of the United Kingdom. 3. At the time of the Syrian quarrel, and when, apprehending some general rupture with England, the Pasha wished to raise the spirit of the fellows and reliver La Morale Nationale, he actually made one of the astonished Arabs a colonel. He degraded him 3 days after peace was concluded. The young Egyptian colonel, who told me this, laughed and enjoyed the joke with the utmost gusto. "Is it not a shame," he said, "to make me a colonel at 23, I, who have no particular merit, and have never seen any service?" Death has since stopped the modest and good-natured young fellow's further promotion. The death of Bey was announced in the French papers a few weeks back. My above kind-hearted and agreeable young informant used to discourse, in our evenings in the Lazaretto at Malta, very eloquently about the beauty of his wife, whom he had left behind him at Cairo, her brown hair, her brilliant complexion, and her blue eyes. "It is this Circassian blood, I suppose, to which the Turkish aristocracy that governs Egypt must be indebted for the fairness of their skin." Ibrahim Pasha, riding by in his barouche, looked like a bluff, jolly-faced English dragoon officer, with a gray mustache and red cheeks, such as you might see on a field day at Maidstone. All the numerous officials riding through the town were quite as fair as Europeans. We made acquaintance with one dignitary, a very jovial and fat Pasha, the proprietor of the inn, I believe, who was continually lounging about the Izbekiya garden, and who, but for a slight Jewish cast of countenance, might have passed any day for a Frenchman. The ladies whom we saw were equally fair, that is, the very slight particles of the persons of ladies which our lucky eyes were permitted to gaze on. These lovely creatures go through the town by parties of 3 or 4, mounted on donkeys, and attended by slaves holding on at the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.